While most people are familiar with the US Navy's Lexington-class battlecruisers, cancelled by the Washington Naval Treaty with two of them converted into large aircraft carriers, there's also a perception among some that battlecruisers were a somewhat silly innovation by the British, with the Germans countering them and the Japanese copying them. But the US Navy, of course, stayed above it all. Usually, this is coupled with an argument that the Lexingtons also weren't battlecruisers in some manner. The destruction over two world wars of invincible, indefatigable Queen Mary and Hood seeming to have somehow tainted the concept. At least retrospectively. Although, interestingly enough, no one really ever brings up poor old Repulse or Lützow when it comes to those kinds of arguments. However, a closer examination of the evidence shows that the US Navy was in fact, either in part or in whole, depending on what year you're looking at, actually quite keen on battle cruisers, with the main restraint on them being the limited budgets set by Congress, which also badly hobbled their regular cruiser and destroyer fleet building programs in the 1900s and the 1910s, and even to a certain degree throttled their battleship building program. So, let's start all the way back in the early 1900s. Even before the Invincible class, in the time of the dinosaurs. Now, anyway, there were two lines of thought that were percolating in the US Navy in the early 1900s. Something which we'll see happens quite a few times over the next couple of decades. One argument, the maximalist argument, ran that the US Navy needed a top-tier Navy, but that it would be both cheaper and more effective to build a smaller number of exceptionally large, all-big-gun vessels. Unified battery vessels at the smaller scale, and than it would be to build more numerous, smaller craft. A roughly 20,000-ton vessel with a dozen 12-inch guns was compared to the then-latest US Navy pre-dreadnought design, the Connecticut's, and it was estimated that 10 of the superships, each capable of 22 knots, would work out at about 20% cheaper, as well as giving a considerably more powerful overall formation, than 20 Connecticut's. Adjacent to this was an acknowledgement that faster scouting units were useful, but that since the United States did not have a large merchant fleet to guard, like the British Empire did, then instead of building a few small and relatively pathetic protected cruisers, the US Navy should invest the money ideally in more of the big fast battleships, or else in a modified version of the big armoured cruisers that were then being designed and built. It was suggested that since the big battleships would already be as fast as many existing armoured cruiser designs, including the Pennsylvanias and Tennessees, which were the latest and greatest in US Navy thought, these latter should be modified by the elimination of all their guns, apart from the main battery, and some basic anti-torpedo boat weapons. The main battery would then be somewhat increased, either by the use of triple turrets instead of twins, or potentially by adding an additional twin turret or two. The guns being 10-inch weapons in the very last generation of US Navy armoured cruisers. All armour, aside from that for the turrets, the deck and the waterline belt, would also be removed, and this would be used to improve the waterline belt protection, with all other weight savings from these two efforts, plus an increase in size, going into more machinery for greater speed. Now, this is fairly recognisable as a battlecruiser in concept, even if the name itself had yet to catch on. The other, somewhat more minimalist approach, independently came up with an idea similar to that of the Japanese Navy's Tsukuba and Ibuki-class armoured cruisers, namely a relatively fast vessel with a pair of twin 12-inch turrets, which would explicitly replace armoured cruisers in the US Navy and form a supplemental force for the battle line. Unlike the Japanese ships, though, which were very much simply larger and more heavily armed armoured cruisers, the US Navy design was labelled a fast battleship, and essentially traded off some armament, compared to the growing demand for all big gun designs, in favour of speed, with protection much closer to battleship than armoured cruiser levels. Imagine either an elongated Connecticut or a slightly less heavily armed South Carolina, for an example. It was this latter idea which would gain more traction as the Monster Fleet proposal ran into the very real issues with political will and thus budget, and from 1904 through 1906, various options on the small fast battleship idea were sketched. Some were more like the Japanese Navy's enlarged armoured cruisers, others followed the more original elongated battleship concept. As such, armament also varied, with some proposing a pair of twin 12-inch turrets, while the then Lieutenant Commander William Sims suggested a 23-knot ship with no less than 9 10-inch guns in 3 triple turrets. However, as the true specifications of the Invincible class began to become apparent to people who weren't in the Royal Navy, views began to diverge once again, but now in completely different directions. In an interesting inversion of Fisher's justification for battlecruisers, some US Navy officers argued that an Invincible-style ship would be the perfect commerce raider, since the large numbers of smaller and slower protected and armoured cruisers used on overseas stations by most navies, and even some of the older battleships that were sometimes used there as station flagships, would be completely unable to deal with such a vessel tearing up the nearby merchant fleets. However, the US Navy's General Board and some other high-ranking groups and officers appear at this point to have completely failed to grasp what a battlecruiser actually was, as much internal discussion was had as a result of advocacy for the Invincible type, but with the Board considering the vessel's utility directly in the battle line, at which point their reduced protection and firepower were roundly condemned, and rightfully so, and since their greater speed was of fairly limited use if you tied into a slower battle fleet, they seemed to just be looking at a big, expensive and vulnerable type of battleship. Indeed, many assertions were made that the Invincibles were just a type of swift battleship and they were therefore judged accordingly. Given their obvious detriments in a battle line, coupled with their high cost in a period of very tight budgets, the concept was thus rejected for construction. Even the brief interlude of proposals for a large, swift vessel armed primarily with torpedoes, the so-called torpedo battleship, didn't change things that much, although it was concluded that the Invincible type was a better idea than the torpedo battleship, and both types relied on higher than average speed, but the Invincible could deliver almost as heavy a torpedo attack, plus it had the advantage of having big guns, and thus was more generally useful. It was, however, also asserted that a vessel with a still further reduced main battery and some more protection would be still more useful, and then you'd fallen back into the armoured cruiser level of territory, and the US Navy wasn't building any more armoured cruisers. Thus, advocacy for battlecruisers fell to the fringes of the US Navy officer corps until 1909, when, faced in part with clear intelligence on how the Royal Navy actually planned to use its battlecruisers, plus the Germans starting to build their own and the Japanese Navy on the lookout for a design that suited their needs, and the Royal Navy, of course, itself continuing to iterate on the battlecruiser idea with new designs, the Naval War College finally decided that, in fact, the battlecruiser was a type of cruiser, primarily intended for scouting, screening, and pursuit of the enemy, rather than a type of battleship. This statement of what to us might seem to be the blindingly obvious opened the gate somewhat once again, and coupled with news soon after of the keel laying of HMS Lion, a still faster and more heavily armed design compared to the 12-inch battlecruiser type, the US Secretary of the Navy soon began soliciting designs for potential battlecruisers from the US Navy itself. This came back in the form of half a dozen concepts that were designed to accompany the Wyoming-class battleships. They varied between 24 and 26,000 tons displacement, with 6, 8, or 10 12-inch guns in twin turrets, all with a speed of 25.5 knots and armour that varied between 8 inches all the way up to the 11 inches of Wyoming herself, usually with the number of guns scaling inversely to the thickness of armour. Interestingly, in contrast with almost every other battlecruiser design in history, the belt armour actually covered a greater area than that of contemporary battleships. This was the result of an odd quirk in US Navy battlecruiser design during this specific period. Whereas the British and to some degree the German battlecruisers worked intensively at refining the underwater hull form to help with speed, as well as going for a finer length to breadth ratio much more in line with their cruisers, most of the US Navy's plans tended to go for a more brute force approach of simply taking an existing battleship hull and making the ship longer, with very few other refinements. Thus, without as advanced underwater hull design refinements, it meant that the hulls had to be abnormally long, even for battlecruisers, to get something like a decent speed. The Wyomings themselves were around 560 feet long. The Invincibles were considerably swifter, and 570 feet long. Now, while the newly laid down Lion class was 700 feet long, and the US designs range from 650 to 690 feet, which might sound in keeping with the Lion class, you've got to remember that the Lion class was carrying armor of a similar thickness to many of the ranges of values under consideration in the US, but they'd be 2 to 3 knots faster and carry a significantly heavier armament. Von der Tann, which was more in keeping with US Navy design ideas in terms of armament, design speed, and at the upper end of the design options protection, was around 5,000 to 6,000 tons lighter than the US designs and over 100 foot shorter. The end result was that US Navy battlecruiser designs typically had a somewhat overstressed hull, to the point where the hull had to be quite deep in order to retain its strength, and the belt had to both protect the hull and, in a number of cases, even provide some of the ship's overall structural strength. Or else, perhaps more commonly, the deck armour became part of the ship's structural strength. But to do so, it had to be placed higher up on the ship, and thus the belt had to rise to meet it. In the end, limited budgets and a still overall hostile general board meant that these designs were also shelved. But then the Japanese Navy went and ordered Kongo, as well as committing to building three sister ships back at home. This proliferation of the battlecruiser type was noted in general, but also was seen to pose a rather specific threat. Since the British and the Germans were clearly in direct competition, the most likely naval conflict involving one of them would have the other on the opposite side, and so to a certain degree, the US Navy didn't think it had to worry so much about their battlecruisers, as the British and German ships would probably end up fighting each other. But the Imperial Japanese Navy, with a battlecruiser squadron, was a direct threat to the US Navy's ambitions in the Pacific. And any and all US Navy armoured cruisers currently stationed out there, perhaps in the Philippines, would be massively vulnerable to them. And so whether they liked it or not, the US Navy looked like it was going to have to be forced to have battlecruisers. And thus, in 1911, the call for a new design was made. It specified that the ship should be armed with 8 14-inch guns, like the Kongo's, but it should be capable of 29 knots and would displace up to 30,000 tons, with long range for Pacific operations, and the best possible protection utilising the all-or-nothing principle that had been developed, or perhaps rediscovered, on the Nevada-class battleships. These would primarily be used independently of the battle fleet. Some suggested that the US Navy's newfangled battlecruiser squadron could roam the Pacific and thus pose enough of a threat in and of themselves to the Japanese Navy to at the very least keep the Japanese off balance until the main US fleet could make its way over from the Atlantic, and perhaps they could even pick off isolated Japanese vessels and small formations. This caused a slew of designs to be produced, the two unchanging elements being the 8 14-inch gun main armament and a fuel figure which was abstracted as requiring enough fuel to sail 8,000 nautical miles at standard battle line cruising speeds, plus additional fuel for the ship to run for 24 hours at full power. The initial estimates looked at a dozen designs, 4 each with different thicknesses of belt armour, 8 inches, 11 inches and 14 inches respectively. As it turned out, with the demands of range, it was only possible to meet the 30,000 ton upper limit on displacement that was proposed with the least capable design, a 29,300 ton ship with 8 inches of belt armour that could only make 26 knots. But even this ship was 750 feet long. Each set of four designs looked at ships capable of 26, 28 and 32 knots, with the 32 knot option represented by two sub-options, one with the required 8,000 nautical mile plus a day speeding along at top power range, and the other with just over 11,500 nautical miles of range. Rather predictably, the sizes of these ships got silly very quickly, the largest being a 32-knot design with 11,650 nautical miles of range that was no less than 1,250 feet long with 14 inches of belt armour and displaced 79,000 tons. With many other designs coming in at between 50 and 65,000 tons. A good part of this was thanks to the spiral of demands caused by the requirement for speed and range on a relatively basic hull, leading to a very long hull, as mentioned before, which in turn led to great stress on the ship, leading to incorporating the deck and to an extent belt armour into the ship's structure, leading to vast areas covered in armour, further increasing the weight, which increased the stress, and on it went. Even in an attempt to mitigate this by only raising the deck armour for a few hundred feet amidships, still had the problem of the belt armour running more than three quarters of the ship's entire length. The fact that at this stage propulsion came courtesy of large tube boilers and direct drive turbines, as opposed to small tube boilers and geared turbines, which would show up in later capital ships in the second half of the 1910s, compounded these issues, as it meant that immense space was needed for the machinery plants. Since most of these designs simply couldn't fit in any existing American dry dock, the specification was revised, taking the second of the 11-inch armoured designs as a basis. This was capable of 29 knots and displaced just over 47,000 tonnes with a 990-foot length. Well, a little bit over that, but who's counting? This was to be trimmed down to 900 feet in hull length, with a range of 8,000 nautical miles plus the 24 hours at full speed, with a secondary armament increased from 5 inches to 6 inches on account of the fact it would be more independently acting, and it would have some torpedo tubes. Attempting to fulfil this requirement yielded a somewhat shorter ship, although it was still 950 foot long, and weight actually ended up going up slightly due to the need for a more powerful machinery plant due to the somewhat lesser length to breadth ratio. Since this design only marginally improved the infrastructure issues, meaning that a single dry dock then being built at Pearl Harbor could just about take it, it was shelved. One last sketch seems to have been made, which reduced the belt armor by 1 inch to just 10 inches, as well as some other small changes, which managed to drop displacement to just over 42,000 tons and length down to 920 feet, but this was still seen as far too large and expensive for the offered capability, and nothing further was done, other than a note left that the mission would shift from independent operations to long-distance recon and scouting for the fleet in the future. And armament of future designs was going to be either 10 14-inch guns, presumably in a Nevada-style layout, or 8 16-inch guns in four twin turrets. Things died away a bit after this, but shortly after, World War I broke out, and battlecruisers were involved in many of the early actions, proving their capability of destroying smaller cruisers utterly. This made the US Navy's previous contention that fleet screens could be done by the cruiser fleet alone completely untenable, and the need for battlecruisers in said fleet screen became more and more obvious. Once more, the thinking split into two lines. In 1915, this resulted in what you might call the high and low end designs. At the upper end, there was another go at a full-scale battlecruiser, now armed with 8 16-inch guns. By significantly reducing the freeboard along the length of the ship, it was possible to avoid the need to make the armour part of the ship's basic structure, and so a shallow 13-inch belt between the turrets was tried, with a very heavy protected deck abreast the turrets, and extending somewhat beyond them. The latter had 8-inch slopes and a 10-inch narrow underwater belt, while the 13-inch belt, as we said, remained between the superfiring turrets, over the machinery for the most part. Still capable of 29 knots, this new design came in at 56,500 tonnes and over 1,060 feet long. It was a couple of thousand tonnes lighter and considerably better armed than its most analogous predecessor in the 1912 design series, but it was still far too big and expensive. An idea to abandon conventional belt armour entirely in favour of just running the heavy protected deck along the whole length of the ship, essentially making a gigantic protected cruiser, saved about 60 feet on length and 4,000 tonnes in weight, while pushing speed up by about a knot. But it was still far too large and had the additional problem of any hit on or above the waterline, now being one that would potentially cause flooding, and at the very least, some internal damage, and the ship lacked enough reserve buoyancy to stay afloat with just its underwater citadel intact. At the lower end of things, however, was the idea of a battle scout. This had started off well in the cruiser category with a proposal for a top speed of 35 knots. And at the lower end of the series, there were designs of just over 10,000 tonnes with 6-inch batteries and armour protection that ranged from distressingly sparse to non-existent. But, as the near three dozen designs went on, displacement grew, and so did armament, with 4 12-inch, 14-inch, or even 16-inch guns considered as displacement headed up towards 20,000 tons, all with little to no armour. As displacement climbed into the high 20s and even low 30,000s of tons, armament included up to 8 14-inch guns, and finally a degree of protection, between 4 and 8 inches of belt, depending on the design. Most of these designs were still aiming for 35 knots, although a few did drop this requirement to a mere 30 knots or so. At this stage, it was clear that the battle scout was beginning to converge with the full battle cruiser, and so they tried again with the battle cruiser. However, the range requirement and the limitations of available boilers and turbines were again kicking the idea to the curb. On a similar displacement to US Navy battleships of the time, a design began to be drafted that aimed to be somewhat better than the approximately 27,000-ton HMS Queen Mary. An armament of 6 16-inch guns in 3 twin turrets was considered, with a 30-knot top speed and 5 inches of deck armour. Unfortunately, it turned out that with just that armament, the armour for the turrets and the secondary battery in place, they ran out of displacement with exactly zero belt protection. Dropping the armament down to a roughly equivalent 8 14-inch guns and introducing a 5-inch thick belt, which would at least protect against light cruisers, still pushed displacement up to 35,500 tons. However, this general concept was still marked for further exploration, resulting in a 32,000-ton design which had 5-inch armour only over the machinery spaces, with a rather brave decision taken to abandon magazine protection entirely, thanks to storing all of the ship's ammunition in the barbettes, which themselves only had 5 inches of armour. Since this meant all the explosives were now well above the waterline and only behind 5 inches of steel, it was rather understandably hastily revised to include some underwater magazines with the belt extended over them at the cost of significantly less reserve feed water and overall a more flimsy hull. Although the new magazines still only had 5 inches of armour, they were at least slightly harder to hit. 4,000 tons could be saved by switching from 14-inch guns down to 10-inch guns, or alternatively, if you stayed back at 32,000 tons, the use of two twin 14-inch turrets up front and a triple aft allowed the 5-inch belt to go all the way to the bow, while the use of a pair of quadruple turrets allowed a gangot-style full-length belt bow to stern, although again it was just 5 inches thick. From these ideas, it was decided to go with the design that had the 5-inch belt covering both machinery and magazines. They were still aiming for 35 knots, now at 33,500 tons, thanks to an increase in armament to 10 14-inch guns with triple turrets superfiring over twins, a bit like the later Pensacola-class cruisers and for similar reasons. This would be the design initially submitted as Congress finally opened its purse a bit in 1916 to massively expand the US Navy. Only for the Battle of Jutland to immediately call a halt to proceedings as people asked the rather reasonable question of if a 5-inch main belt was really going to stop the new US Navy battlecruisers from popping just as fast, or perhaps even faster, than three British battlecruisers just had. The US Navy defended the design on the basis that the British ships hadn't died from lack of protection, but rather from poor ammunition handling practices. This was a somewhat dubious argument given that the 9-inch belt of the later British battlecruisers had in fact protected them from some direct magazine impacts, and at least one British battlecruiser, Indefatigable, had sunk from what was almost certainly a direct or near-direct hit to the magazines, where 5-inch armour had rather decidedly, obviously, failed to save her. The reason for the thin armour was entirely down to the 35-knot speed requirement. The massive machinery plant required for this, coupled with the choice to use turbo-electric drive, which took up more space anyway, meant that additional boilers were actually stacked atop the turbine rooms, meaning that boilers ran all the way up to the upper deck level, well above the limits of even the 5-inch belt, and thus directly vulnerable to even destroyer-grade gunfire, although the officers in charge tried to sell the idea as at least meaning that some of the boilers were immune to torpedoes, because they were too high above the waterline. With the British eventually settling on both improving ammunition handling and significantly upgrading magazine protection, where possible on existing designs and more significantly on newer ones, the up-armouring of the under-construction hood and the re-armouring a couple of years later of Renown and Repulse being examples of this, the final form of what was now being dubbed the Lexington class was now very much up for debate. The US entry into World War I the next year meant that work on the ships was suspended in favour of mass production of smaller craft, and as a result, the design was able to be revised a number of times. This presented both opportunities and challenges. Strong pressure was exerted to increase the main battery from 14-inch to 16-inch guns, with some considerable debate as to if this meant dropping the number of guns from 10 to 6, which would also mean losing a turret, or from 10 to 8, which would mean having four twin turrets. The latter idea eventually won out. At the same time, using newer boilers with small tubes meant that the number and size of boiler rooms could be reduced, which brought the machinery fully under the armour once again. This also meant that the ships only needed 5 funnels instead of 7. With the overall cost of increasing the armament while decreasing the weight of the machinery, meaning that just under 2,000 tons more displacement was needed, with the design sitting now at just over 35,000 tons. It was briefly considered to try and up the armour belt to 9 inches, which, at least at the longer ranges promised by the new 16-inch 50 caliber guns, might provide some protection against smaller shells, and it was also thought maybe we should actually have some torpedo defences. But this would drop speed to 33 knots and increase displacement to around 45,000 tons. Then, in 1918, Stanley Goodall showed up, a British naval architect and later director of naval construction, and he quickly showed the US Navy how Hood was designed. Impressed at battleship levels of firepower and protection, with battlecruiser speed, the US Navy used his expertise to design their version of what they saw Hood as, a meeting of battleship and battlecruiser. The result was a proposed successor to the Lexingtons with a baseline design that called for the same armament as current battleships, with a maximum acceptable armour reduction compared to those battleship designs of 10%, with the ship capable of 30 knots of speed. Using turboelectric drive, Goodall's concept of angled belt armour of about 11 to 12 inches of thickness almost matched the 13.5-inch vertical belt of US standard battleships, and the 1920 South Dakota's dozen 16-inch guns were added to the ship to give two designs, one of 48,500 tons and another of 53,000 tons, the main differences being length and fine details of the armour layout, but these weren't proceeded with as post-war economies began to bite. The US Navy also tried to argue, based on this visit's experience, for uprating the Lexington's belt armour thickness, which at this stage was still just 5 inches. The General Board refused any increase at all, claiming that they saw no advantage to it, given that it would almost certainly mean the ship would have to abandon the aim of 35 knots of top speed. But the US Navy's officers were growing increasingly concerned. The now Admiral Sims argued that the Lexingtons should be redesigned with Hood's 12-inch inclined armour, and he wasn't alone. Eventually, in early 1919, it was decided to suspend further work on the Lexingtons to allow a full, considered discussion and debate about everything that had been learned since the 5-inch belt version had been signed off on. The General Board and the Bureau of Ordnance stuck to their guns, but eventually a compromise was forced. The Lexingtons would have even newer boilers, allowing the funnels to be reduced once more to just 2 large trunked units, and armour would be increased to 7 inches at a mild slope, along with a little bit more deck armour. This meant that target displacement would rise to 42,500 tonnes, and speed would drop to just over 33 knots. But that would mark the end of US Navy battlecruiser development, for the Lexingtons would be cancelled as a result of the Washington Naval Treaty, with Lexington and Saratoga instead being converted into carriers, drawing down a curtain on a rather interesting set of potential developments that had some good ideas, and honestly, some downright terrible ones as well.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.